A little over a year and a half ago, Nancy Pelosi was voted in as the Speaker of the House, the highest elected office any American woman has ever attained. She is second in line, presidential succession behind Vice President Cheney, and gets to set the agenda for the House of Representatives. And she's here with a new book that encourages young women to follow her example and take on more leadership roles. It's written with the help of Amy Hill Hearth and called Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. Doubleday is the publisher, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, back to the show. Hello. It's good to see you again.
It's wonderful to be back. Thank you.
In the past year or so, America has witnessed your rise to the—do we call it speakership?
Yes.
And Senator Hillary Clinton's serious run for the Democratic presidential nomination. Despite that, do you continue to worry that young women aren't accepting or seeking out enough power in America?
Well, whether they are or not, I want them to do more. The I believe that the increased participation of women in the political and governmental process is the most wholesome change that we have seen. And so I say to women, know your power and use it. And if that means coming into the political process, come on in, the water's warm.
How did you come up with that phrase, know your power?
A great woman who was a mentor to many of us named Lindy Boggs. She was a congresswoman from Louisiana and later the ambassador to the Vatican.
And mother of one of NPR's favorite correspondents.
Cokie Roberts. And she one time I was saying to her before I was in Congress, I said, Congresswoman, I'm chairing the host committee for the convention. I'm the chair of the California Democratic Party as we were trying to get the convention, and I'm chair of the delegate selection piece of it. They're all separate, but I think maybe I have too many opportunities, and I should pass one of them on to someone else. And she said, darling, no man would ever think that way. Know your power. But actually, she said, know thy power. And when she said that, I thought, that's right. All of these things reinforce each other. I can make some change here. And so that has inspired me, as well as something that I say to others, that know your power. Think about what you have inside of you. Understand your uniqueness.
And if you'd come from Louisiana, would you be saying know thy power?
No, I changed it to know your power because I just did.
Well, what do you say? Is that what you say to young women? Is that what you say to young women when you hear them complain about the direction the country's going in?
Well, it's not a question of them complaining. It's a question of them saying, what can we do about it? And I say, know your own power and how you can affect change. Because anything is possible. I tell people that there's nothing more eloquent to a member of Congress in the voice of his or her own constituents. And that's how we all start as advocates and then perhaps attain our own power.
Doesn't it matter where you are if you're a woman who is seeking to know her own power? I spoke a while back to a woman who had run for mayor of a major city in Pennsylvania, and she said that she'd been invited by the Gowanus Club or one of those clubs. And the male candidate gave his speech, and then she started giving her speech. In the middle, the head of the group said, wait a minute, I have to ask you a question that's on everyone in this room's minds. What are your measurements? And she said she was just stunned. She didn't really know how to proceed after that. She said to him, what are your measurements? But But you,
that is stunning. Well,
that was in the year 2006.
That recent, because when I ran over 20 years ago for Congress, 21 years ago, people would say to me, and I thought this was going to be your question, who's taking care of your children?
Yeah, well, they did even with Hillary. They said, iron my shirts. Did you see those?
That's ridiculous.
Those hecklers?
That's ridiculous. Well, they're hecklers. I'm talking about serious people asking a serious question at a town meeting. And my children were grown by the time I ran for Congress. My youngest was a senior in high school. So my children were taking care of me. But I said to the women, I said, you must be prepared to answer this question to the satisfaction of people because their comfort level requires that.
Do you recommend going about it the way that you did, raise a family first and then seek public office?
Well, that worked for me, but in this day and age, young women have many more options. And when I was raising my family, it wasn't with the idea that this was step one and step two would be a political career. I had no idea what was on the horizon for me. But I say to people, young women, when they ask me what works best, to have your family and then a career, your career and then a family, and just whatever works for them is what works best. Their timing is what they have to work with.
And you write a lot about that time in your life in the book. How did you end up entering public office?
Quite serendipitously. I was born in a political family, so I've always had a high regard for public service.
Yeah, and we talked about the last time you were here, growing up in Maryland in a very a very political family.
Right. When I was born, my father was a member of Congress from Maryland. And from the time I was in first grade until I went to college, when I was in college, he was still the mayor of Baltimore. So it was the only life that we knew, and a life of public service and, of course, campaigns that go with it. So anyway, put that aside. My husband and I marry. He's a Californian. We live in San Francisco. We have 5 children in 6 years. Almost to the day, and I was totally engrossed in raising my family. Well, my youngest is 37 years old, so that was a long time ago. But it is, and that's why I say to young women, raising a family is the biggest challenge and the most important job that anyone could have. So, take inventory of your strengths, and again, when somebody say, what do you do? Well, I'm just a housewife. I said, why would you even think such a thing? That's such an important responsibility. And understand that it forges you. It disciplines you in schedule and routine and diplomacy and discipline and organization. And so anyway, when my children, one thing led to another, and I became involved as a volunteer in politics just while they were in school during the day. And then sadly, my congresswoman passed away, and she had asked me to run for her seat, and that's in the book.
But first, you were appointed to a library commission, which I wondered, is that like starting in the mailroom and then working your way up?
I didn't think so. I thought it was the greatest honor. I love books, and I love libraries, and when the mayor of San Francisco, Joe Eliotto, this is a long time ago, asked me to serve as a library commissioner, first I was being typical of a woman, I'd say, I don't really need the title. I'll do the work. I don't need the title. And then he said, yes, you do need the title. And then I loved it.
It gave you that power that you later came to know. Nancy Pelosi has written with Amy Hill Hearth, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters, which is published by Doubleday. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So when Congresswoman Sally Burton, who, as you said, was dying and asked you to run for her seat, asked you that, what was your first reaction? I'll take the job, but don't give me the title?
No. My first reaction was I have never had any interest or intention of running for public office. But I was chair of the California Democratic Party. I had been. And she said, you love the issues. That's why you're involved in politics. This way you can work on the issues, not just support those who do. And, well, she convinced me that I should consider it. I took it up with my family, talked to my daughter, Alexandra, who was going into senior year in high school. I said, one more year would be better. She'd be off in college as the others had all gone. And she said, Mother, get a life. And I did.
You write about an experience you had in 2002 when you became the Democratic leader of the House. You were seated at a table where no elected female politician had ever sat.
Yeah.
What was the purpose of that meeting?
Well, this was a meeting that was very transformational, maybe for me. I was invited to the White House for my first meeting as a leader of the Democrats in the Congress. And I was not apprehensive about the meeting. I had been to the White House for meetings many times as an appropriator, member of the Appropriations Committee, member of the Intelligence Committee. So I just took it in stride, went to the meeting. But when the door closed behind me, I realized that this was unlike any meeting I had ever been to before. In fact, it was unlike any meeting any woman had ever been to before. There was the president, the vice president, the Democratic and Republican leadership of the Congress, and I was there as the with my power springing from the Democrats in the House of Representatives. Women certainly have been at the table with the president as his appointees in that respect, but my power did not derive from the president. It derived from my being elected and so being there in my own right. And what happened was when I was sitting there just as the meeting began, all of a sudden I felt great. The president began to welcome me and congratulate me, this or that, and I felt very crowded in my seat. It was like I was all kinds of people were sitting on the same chair with me, and I was closed in. I can just feel it. It was palpable. I could feel the presence of others. This had never happened to me before. And as we were sitting there, it was as if Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and everyone you can think of, the suffragettes, and Alice Paul, and you name it, they were all sitting on the chair with me, and I could hear them say, "At last, we have a seat at the table." And then they were gone. But it was a physical presence, but I felt it.
Was there also disappointment because some of the people who were at that table turn out to not be all that brilliant? Or was the power of the conversation so overwhelming that you didn't think along those lines?
Well, the point is that everybody is there for a reason, has a legitimate stake or representation at the table, but gone would be the days now where you'd be at a meeting, and I'm sure every woman has experienced this, where you'll be seated at a meeting and you'll make a suggestion and the men at the table will not say much, and then a couple minutes later a man at the table will make the same suggestion and they'll all say, "What a great idea." Or later in the conversation, they'll reference that man saying it, but not you who originally put it on the table. Well, that doesn't happen to me. Once you have the gavel, it's over.
Many people have looked to Hillary Clinton as an example of a woman who has succeeded in what is largely a male-dominated political arena. But I don't remember you mentioning her in the book. How would you compare your approach to politics, how you debate or build consensus for bills?
Compare with whom? With Hillary Clinton?
With Hillary, because you
I have a different role.
Women in Congress.
Well, I have a different role. Hillary Clinton, and I have enormous respect for Hillary Clinton. As I've said, I think she has emerged from the presidential race as the most respected political figure in America. What she did for our country, was also for our party, but for women, was groundbreaking, and women will not leave that ground broken. So we're all deeply in her debt. I have a different role. I'm a legislator. I'm the Speaker of the House. I'm not a senator running for president. I have to build consensus. When I speak with consensus of my caucus, not as an individual person. And so, but we all share the values of a fairer economy for all Americans, a safer place for our children, an agenda of opportunity and fairness and safety for our country.
Do you think that your experience as a housewife and mother influenced your leadership style?
They tell me it has. Certainly, with five children, 6 years old and under, and five teenagers all at one time and the rest, you do learn a lot about discipline, organization, and diplomacy.
And you're here with one of your daughters.
Yes, my daughter Alexandra is here, and sometimes, my husband is with me, Paul, as well, but Alexandra is in the business. I mean, she's a documentarian, and she's said a number of truths to me, like get a life, as I said earlier, and in any case, the focus that you have, and this is what I want women to understand. I know as well as anyone how difficult it is to raise a family. It's a joy beyond words. It's a delight. It's all of that, but it's hard and it's constant, and it's forging. It disciplines you. It forges you, and it builds strength and stamina for what comes next. So in terms of discipline, focus, organization, diplomacy, strength, stamina, I think my role as mother and wife have helped me in my role as Speaker of the House.
And in this book, sometimes you use language, not just in this book, in fact, everywhere, that references things like house cleaning. In fact, you recently in an article where you called George Bush a total failure after he criticized Congress for failing to get a series of bills passed. You said Congress is sweeping up after the president's mess.
Yeah, we have our sports analogies and we have our housekeeping analogies. And for me, I think some of the housekeeping analogies like that we had to clean house when we came in and pass the biggest ethics reform bill in the history of the Congress and sweep up after George Bush and the terrible harm that he and his administration have done to the country, to our economy, to our budget, to our Constitution, the war in Iraq, the energy crisis, you name it. So, yeah, there's a lot of sweeping up. And I think it's important for people to know that we have to use any analogy we can, but make it clear that there's work to be done.
You were responding to the president's, on CNN, criticism that the Democratic, or he says Democrat-led Congress, was heading into the final 26 days of the legislative session without having passed a single government spending bill.
So, and well, what part of the problem is that every time, anytime we have a statement of our values and reflected in our investments in the spending bills, the president will say $1 more and I will veto the bill. He did that, for example, in funding relating to biomedical research, cancer research, and the rest. Last time we passed the bill with more funding, he vetoed it. We couldn't override. So we're trying to find a place where we can have these bills signed into law. But that was an idle challenge by the president. It just speaks to the lack of ideas on the part of him and the Republicans to grow our economy and create good-paying jobs here in our country, expand health care, protect our people. The list goes on.
This is the sort of thing we've heard over the years from various presidents, do nothing Congress and that sort of thing. But in Congress, does that bother people?
Well, it doesn't bother me because the fact is that while Congress isn't an institution that has historically been a mockable one and it's hard to lift the standing of Congress, although as Speaker I will certainly try, especially when we have a president who shares our values. The issues that we care about, our first bill, H.R. 1, to protect the American people, passing the 9/11 Commission recommendations, raising the minimum wage, giving the biggest increase in veterans benefits in the history, 77-year history of the Veterans Administration, the biggest package for college affordability since the 1944 GI Bill of Rights, passing stem cell research, which the president vetoed, passing our energy bill, not all of it, we still want more. This week, I'm very excited because this week we're going to pass, first time in a long time, equal pay for equal work. I mean, for the first time in our history, women will receive this. Instead of 70 cents compared to a dollar, women will receive equal pay for equal work. And this week we will pass consumer product safety so that our children's toys, et cetera, will not be harmful to their health.
So equal pay for equal work is kind of like the ERA revisited, but as a federal law instead of as a constitutional amendment.
Well, the ERA had other considerations as well, but this will be an economic manifestation of it.
Nancy Pelosi is here. She's written a book with the help of Amy Hill Hearth called Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. It is published by Doubleday. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Nancy Pelosi is here. She became Speaker of the House in January 2007. And that after serving 20 years in Congress. She's written a book with – this is your second book?
No, it's my first book. My daughter Alexandra has written a book. My daughter Christine has written a book.
Because you were here before, and I just assumed that it was with some book, but it wasn't.
No, I was just here.
Well, this one is written with the help of Amy Hill Hearth, and it's called Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters, published by Doubleday. Can I return to that criticism, you calling the president total failure? Did you receive a lot of criticism for that other than from Fox News?
Not really. I got a lot of positive feedback from it, but it was nothing personal to the president. It was just a statement of fact. And to those who criticized me for what I said about the president's failure in terms of the economy, energy, the war, the budget, the Constitution, I said I said it the way I said it because I was being polite.
Why do you think Congress's approval rating is at 18%, even lower than the president's?
The war. I think quite frankly, I don't approve of the way that Congress has dealt with the war. In the House of Representatives, we've five or six times sent clear legislation for the redeployment of our troops out of Iraq honorably, responsibly, safely, and soon. They've hit a brick wall in the United States Senate, but the public doesn't understand that process and really shouldn't have to worry about that. We should be able to have put more legislation on the president's desk, but I can only answer for the House. But I think that's the case. I'm not discouraged.
Do you think that'll be resolved by the presidential election?
I do. I do. I think that it will be. And what?
One way or the other.
I
know which way you want it to go.
Is it 97 more days until here's the thing. The war in Iraq is the overwhelming, again, judgment against Congress. But I'm very pleased with the ratings that the Democrats have. That's Congress. But the Democrats have high ratings on almost every issue you can name. It's in the double digits, sometimes 20 points, whether it's health care, taxes, the economy, the environment, global warming, you name it. I'm very confident about our success in November, but not taking anything for granted. And, of course, we're all working very hard to elect Barack Obama president of the United States.
In the past, issues like Iraq, the Republicans would question the patriotism of Democrats, and we've seen a little bit of that recently with John McCain kind of saying that, although then denying that he said that about Barack Obama. How did the Democrats get past that? Or has the situation so deteriorated that they don't have to worry about it anymore?
Well, the fact is our first responsibility is to protect the American people, and we take that very seriously. And so, as I said, the first act of Congress was to pass the 9/11 Commission recommendations. Part of that is to build a military second to none, and President Bush is deteriorating our military right now, undermining the capacity of our military to respond to any threats to our security. So he's not making us safer, and with this war, he's not making the region more stable. But connections that we have in a very strong way is with Americans' veterans. I made that a priority when I became leader almost 6 years ago to honor our promises to our veterans. And as I said, we passed the biggest package for health care for veterans in the 77-year history of the Veterans Administration, and we passed the GI Bill. We said to our veterans, thank you, and when you come home, we want you to be able to go to college. And so we work with them. They give us their priorities. We have turned them into law. They have written me. I've been the unsung heroine. I've gotten all kinds of awards from the veterans groups, the veteran service organizations. So I think that we have neutralized some of the idea that Republicans were better for veterans. The fact is the Republicans had neglected the veterans. But again, one issue at a time, whether it's the capability of our military, the strength of our diplomatic alliances, the honor that we pay to our veterans, I think Democrats are neutralizing that issue.
You and the Democrats have worked on several energy bills in the last month, all meant to address our dependence on foreign oil. And you've been adamant at keeping the Republicans from lifting the ban on offshore drilling. I assume part of that is because you're from California, but you gave me a look.
It goes well beyond California. But, of course, I'm a Californian. It's in the DNA there in terms of protecting the coast, but other states want to protect their coast as well. And you know what? Their neighboring states want them to protect their coast. But here's the thing. In the last 2 weeks or so, we've seen this big brouhaha about if only we could drill. And now John McCain has said the reason our economy is in trouble is because we won't allow drilling on offshore drilling. Well, that is that's so sad because for two reasons. First of all, if we drilled offshore in the protected areas, it would take down the price of gasoline 2 cents in about 10 years. Second of all, John McCain has not, he only recently in June changed his position to be in opposition to a ban on offshore drilling. And when he made his announcement in the middle of June, he had a record-breaking, say, $1 million in 2 weeks that he raised from executives and employees of oil and power companies. It's a flip-flop on the part of John McCain. But more important,
the ban was imposed by George Bush
the first. Father. Yes, President Bush, 41. And for the president, bless his heart, for him to say that but for offshore drilling, as similar to what McCain said, the economy would be thriving. I just can't let them get away with that because, first of all, it's not true. Second of all, the president has even come to say publicly that there are no short-term fixes on the cost price at the pump and that drilling offshore in these protected areas will not make any difference for many years to come. But for them to say with their failed economic policies, with their tax cuts for the wealthiest people in America at the expense of the middle class, with their lack of investments into technologies for the future, for them to say it's just banning oil, and so gas is at $4 a gallon because of their policies, and them to exploit that issue, try to exploit that issue, and also apply it to the economy, I can't let them get away with that.
You talk about the qualities that make a good leader in your book, specifically in being able to build a coalition. How will that apply when you're trying to push through this energy legislation? Will you be able to, or is it so partisan that it would be impossible?
Did. Actually, we did. We pushed forth a large percentage of our energy agenda last year, and it was signed into law by the president. And it was the first time in 32 years we had a CAFE standards, the reduction in emissions and higher mileage per gallon for gasoline. 32 years we had not had a bill signed into law by the president. That was that was historic. We had an enormous savings in terms of efficiencies and conservation in the bill, be the equivalent of taking every car in America off the road for 1 year, the efficiencies in that bill. So I'm very proud of that. It didn't go far enough because the Republicans in the Senate would not support our investment tax credit and production tax credits. But we haven't given up on that. We're going to try to bring it up this week or next week or as soon as we come back again.
The White House, in fact.
Again, it's stalled in the Senate. It's passed the House 4 times.
So is that part of the problem? Because
yes.
The Senate is also controlled by the Democrats, and yet I get the feeling again and again that we have two Democratic parties working in two different houses.
No, the Senate Democrats are very aggressive on these issues. In fact, the CAFE standard began in the Senate with the Senate Democrats. The issue is that you need 60 votes in the Senate. A simple majority is not enough. And so if you need 60 votes, you need Republicans to vote for these issues. Now, on all of these, we've had strong bipartisan support, but on repealing subsidies to big oil in order to pay for investments in renewable energy resources or giving tax credits, the Republicans, we can only get 59 votes. But I'm hoping this week we'll get 60.
I was thinking about another bill when I mentioned the Senate. Last week you appeared with Al Gore at the Progressive Netroots Nation blogging conference, and you were heckled over the outcome of the FISA Act.
Yeah.
Many progressives were angered that the telecom companies ended up gaining retroactive immunity for their part in wiretapping investigations. And that actually came out of the negotiations with the Senate, didn't it? That
it did. And really, most of the time, every time, 99.5% of the time, it is the Republicans in the Senate being part of the problem. This time, the Democrats were complicit in terms of 17 Democrats voting with the Republicans to give them a majority for a bill.
Including Barack Obama.
For a bill that was not—no, I'm talking about earlier on.
Oh.
Earlier on, not Barack Obama then, giving them a majority for a bill that was really totally unacceptable. So then we had to go to a compromise, and the compromise is what Barack Obama and I voted for. We all opposed giving a retroactivity to the telecom companies, but because they shouldn't have had it, but it not because we would have learned so much from it. I'm pleased that in the bill we will have an inspector general who can help us get to the heart of the matter. But remember, in the bill, that it was improved by protecting American citizens overseas and how they're collected upon. It insisted on exclusivity, that the FISA law is the exclusive means by which the government can collect. Before, they were saying inherent authority of the president, which means crown me king. It was exclusive. In other words, the Republicans were saying, you can have that exclusivity, but it'll only apply to these three things. And we said, no, it applies to everything. We won that point. We won on almost every point except the retroactivity, which is a big thing in terms of message. But in terms of getting the facts, we can get that from the Inspector General. But our Democratic House bill was the appropriate bill. We couldn't get that past the Senate.
The first question that bloggers asked you at the conference was why you are reluctant to take up impeachment proceedings on President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And people have been asking you that since you became Speaker. It's my sense that after what happened with Bill Clinton and the impeachment proceedings there and the way they just seem to be so cheapen the whole idea of impeachment, that it's going to be harder and harder to impeach a president in the future. I'm not arguing whether this president should be impeached or not, but Let me respond
to you this way. First of all, I do think it was wrong for them to impeach President Clinton. It was foolish. It was frivolous and a waste of the time. In terms of the impeachment, there's a great deal of anger in our country among many people that the president should have been impeached. You know who would have been the happiest people in the world if we had started impeachment proceedings on the president? The Republicans. They know that their goose is cooked with the American people. They have, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier in terms of the economy, et cetera. But here's the thing. I came in as Speaker of the House. I have a plan for a progressive economic agenda for the future. But we have to win the White House to do that. So I could spend my time doing this or trying to unify the country around a strong Democratic victory. I have a plan. 2006 was step one, 2008 step two, an elected president, 2010, 2012, to change where we are. Here we are in an economy where the wealthiest people in America are sucking up, extracting from the economy because of public policy. They're not doing it, but the law enables the extraction of hundreds of billions of dollars out of our economy. At the expense of the middle class, to the benefit of the wealthiest people in America. It isn't creating jobs. It isn't strengthening our economy. You see its impact all over. And what we have to do is get control back so we say, this is America. Everybody should participate in the prosperity of our country. We need a fair economic policy. We need to do it in a way that strengthens the middle class, which strengthens our democracy. I have a long-term plan for that. And we cannot do it if we distract ourselves with these other things. Now, if somebody has a crime that the president has committed, I completely disagree with him. I think he's outrageous. But do we have an impeachable offense? I'd rather spend my time building a fairer economy and electing Democrats to the White House and the Congress.
And we'll be seeing you as the chair of the Democratic Convention in Denver. The book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. We should keep in mind that still only 17% of all elected officials in this country are women. So you might want to read this book. Nancy Pelosi will be in conversation with Dr. Gail Saltz tomorrow at noon at the 92nd Street Y. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today
to talk about this book. Thank you, Leonard. I'm excited about the book. And as far as women in power, we want more.